which turned it into a green tunnel. The raccoons seemed to like that part, and I was careful to avoid the little clumps of their scat. There was a gazebo at the end of the boardwalk. After that, the trees fell away to a wide sweep of beach grass and dune reeds. The sound of the waves was mild and soothing. Gulls and terns circled, loafing on the gulf breeze. There were other birds, too. Big uns and little uns. Greg was an amateur ornithologist and would have known them all. I did not. I looked south where there were great tangles of underbrush. A few palms poked above them, but they looked tattered and unhealthy, probably because the trash growth was sucking up most of the nutrient-rich groundwater. It was there that Jake and Joe must have come to grief. I could see the Bell Boardwalk, and if they had only taken that instead of trying to play jungle explorers, they would also be in their 40s, maybe pushing their own youngsters in that old stroller. If-onlys are also rattlesnakes, I think. They are full of poison. I left the gazebo behind and headed north along the beach, which was wide and wet and shining in the sun. There would be a lot less beach that afternoon, and almost none by evening when the tide was high. Mr. Ito said it didn't used to be that way. He said it was global warming, and by the time Eddie was his age, the beach would be gone. It was a pleasant walk with the gulf on my left and the dunes on my right. Greg Ackerman's was the last house on the quay. North of his property, county land took over, and the tangled undergrowth reappeared, growing so close to the beach that I occasionally had to brush away palmetto branches and step over big clumps of beech and alpaca. Then the foliage ended, and the beach widened into a lopsided triangle deep in shells. Here and there I spotted shark's teeth, some as big as my index finger. I picked a few up and put them in my pocket, thinking I'd give them to Donna. Then I remembered, oh snap, that my wife was dead. Bitten again, I thought. The triangle was lopsided because Daylight Pass had cut off the beach. Water ran against the tide from Calypso Bay, first fighting the mid-gulf waves and swirling in a whirlpool before joining them. It was a hurricane that opened Daylight, which had been closed 90 years before. So I'd read in a pictorial history of the South Keys, which had been on Greg's coffee table when I took up residence. Across the way was a floating patch of greenery, all that remained of Duma Key, which had been inundated in the same hurricane that opened the pass. I lost interest in picking up shark's teeth. Remembering your wife is dead will do that, I guess. So just put my hands in my pockets and looked at the shell beach where Rattlesnake Key ended. It was to this dead end that the hunting party had driven the infestation of snakes. A group of lawyers is an eloquence. A group of rattlesnakes is a rumba. I didn't know how I knew that, but I did. The mind isn't just a venomous reptile that sometimes bites itself. It's also an enthusiastic garbage picker. Freddie Cannon released his 45s on the Swan label, which bore the message, "Don't drop out." James Garfield's middle name was Abram. Those are also things I know, but don't know how I know. I stood there, with the breeze rippling my shirt and the birds circling overhead, and the green mop of foliage that marks what's left of Duma Key rising and falling with the waves as if it were breathing. How had they driven the snakes here? That was a thing I didn't know. And once they got them here, how had they killed those that didn't try to escape by swimming away? I didn't know that either. I heard a squeak from behind me, then another. The sweat on the nape of my neck turned cold. I didn't want to turn my head because I was sure I'd see that double stroller with the dead twins inside had swollen from snake bites, but because I had nowhere to go. Like the rattlers, and didn't believe in ghosts. I did. There were a couple of gulls standing there. White heads, black bodies. Beady eyes asking what the hell I was doing trespassing on their spot. Because I was scared, I threw a couple of shark's teeth at them. They weren't as big as the shells I'd thrown at the buzzards, but they did the job. The gulls flew off, squawking indignantly. Squawking. What I'd heard behind me had been squeaking, like the wheel that needs some grease. I told myself that was bullshit, and could almost believe it. The breeze brought the smell of something that might have been kerosene or gasoline. It didn't surprise me. Florida politicians, from the governor right down to the city and town councils, are more interested in business than they are in preserving the Gulf Coast's fragile ecosystem. They abuse it, and eventually they will lose it. I looked for the telltale rainbow of gas or oil on the surface, or turning at the edges of that constant whirlpool, and saw nothing. Breathed deep and smelled nothing. Went back home, which was how I was now thinking of Greg Ackerman's house. I don't know if remarriages work as a rule, if there are statistics. I haven't seen them. Ours did. Was it because of the long gap? Those years when we didn't see each other, then fell out of touch completely? The shock of reconnection? That might have been part of it. Or was it because the terrible wound of our son's death had had time to heal? Maybe. But I wonder if couples ever get over a thing like that. Speaking just for myself, I thought of Tad less often, but when I did, the hurt was nearly as strong as ever. One day at the office, I remembered how I used to read him the monster words before bedtime, a catechism that was intended to banish his fear of the dark, and had to sit down on a toilet in the office bathroom and cry. That wasn't a year or two or even 10 after it happened. That was when I was in my 50s. Now I'm in my 70s. And I still don't look at pictures of him, although there was a time when I stored many on my phone. Donna said she did, but only on what would have been his birthday, a kind of ritual. But she was always stronger than I was. She was a soldier. I think most first marriages are about romance. I'm sure there are exceptions, people who marry for money or to improve their station in life some other way. But the majority are powered by the giddy, gliding, feeling pop songs are written about. The Wind Beneath My Wings is a good example, both because of the feeling it evokes and because of the corollary the song doesn't go into. Eventually, the wind dies. Then you have to flap those wings if you don't want to crash land. Some couples find a tougher love that endures after the romance thins away. Some couples discover that tougher love just isn't in their repertoire. Instead of discussing money, they argue about it. Suspicion replaces trust. Secrets blossom in the shadows. And some marriages break up because a child dies. Allie Bell's didn't, but might have if her husband hadn't died not long after. No coronary for me, only panic attacks. I kept a paper bag in my briefcase and huffed into it when they came on. Eventually they stopped. When Donna and I remarried, there was an older love, kinder and more reserved. There were none of the money arguments that bedevil many young couples who are just starting out. I had done well in the ad biz, and Donna was the superintendent of one of the biggest school districts in southern Maine. On the evening I saw her in that bar, she was in Providence for a New England conference of school administrators. Her yearly salary wasn't as big as mine, but it was generous. We both had 401ks. Our financial needs were met. The sex was satisfactory, although without a lot of fireworks, except maybe for that first time after our long, ha-ha, layoff. She had her house, I had mine, and that was how we lived. The commute wasn't a big problem. It turned out that we'd been living just 70 miles apart for all those in-between years. We weren't together all the time, and that was okay. We didn't need to be. When we were, it was like being with a good friend that you just happened to sleep with. We worked at the relationship in a way that couples just starting out don't need to do, because they have that wind beneath their wings. Older couples, especially those with a terrible darkness in their past that they need to avoid, have to flap. That's what we did. Donna took early retirement, and in 2010, we became a one-house couple, mine in Newburyport. It was her decision. At first, I thought it was because she wanted more together time, and I was right about that, just not why she felt more together time had become necessary. We spent a week getting her settled. Then she asked me one sunshiny October Saturday if I'd walk with her by the rock wall that divides my property from the Merrimack River. We held hands and kicked through the leaves, listening to the crackle and smelling that sweet cinnamon odor they get before they go limp and start to decay. It was a beautiful afternoon with big fat clouds sailing across a blue sky. I said it looked like she had lost weight. She said that was true. She said it was because she had cancer. I was afraid that thinking about the buzzards tearing into Allie would keep me awake. So I went poking through Greg's double-sized medicine cabinet, always a bit of a hypochondriac, my friend, and found an Ambien prescription with four left in the bottle. According to the label, this particular helping of sleep medicine had expired in May of 2018, but I thought, what the hell, and took a couple. Maybe they worked. Maybe it was just the placebo effect, but I slept all night and with no dreams. I woke refreshed at 7 the next morning and decided to make my regular walk, feeling I couldn't avoid the spot where Allie died for the rest of my stay. I put on shorts and sneakers and went downstairs to start the Keurig. Greg's driveway opens into a large courtyard on the side of the house. A window at the foot of the stairs looks out on this courtyard. I got 2 steps from the bottom of the stairs and froze, staring. The stroller was out there. I couldn't believe it. Couldn't quite take it in. I felt it had to be a trick of the shadows. Only in that early morning light there were no shadows. Except, that is, for the one thrown by the stroller. It was there. It was real. More than the object itself, the shadow proved it. Shadows don't exist unless there's something to make them. After my initial brain freeze, I was afraid. Someone, some mean person, had come here and left that stroller to freak me out. It worked. I was freaked out. I couldn't think who would have done such a thing. Certainly not Officer Zane or Canavan. Mr. Ito had probably heard of Mrs. Bell's death. News travels fast in small communities, but he wasn't the practical joker type, and his son spent most of the time in internet dreamland. There were no usual suspects, and in a way, that didn't matter. What mattered was that someone had come to my house in what the pulp novelists call the dead of night. Had I locked up? In my initial shock and fright, at first I wasn't even angry. I couldn't remember. I'm not sure I could have remembered my late wife's middle name just then had I been asked. I rushed to the front door. Locked. I went to the one that gave on the pool in the patio. Locked. I went to the back door, which opens into the garage, and that one was locked too. So at least no one had actually been inside doing a midnight creep. It should have been a relief, but it wasn't. One of the cops must have left that thing, I thought. Zane locked the garage and took the keys. There was logic there, but I just didn't believe it. Zane had seemed solid, dependable, far from dumb. Also, was a key to the garage really necessary? Probably not. The lock on the side door looked like the kind you could pop with a coat hanger or a credit card. I went out to look at the stroller. I thought there might be a note of the sort that would be left behind in a creepy grade C suspense movie. "You're next," and "go back where you came from," both came to mind. There was no note. There was something worse. Yellow shorts on one seat, red shorts on the other. Not the same ones as yesterday. and shirts draped across the backs, also not the same. I didn't want to touch those shirts, and didn't have to in order to read what was on them. Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Twin shirts for sure, but the twins who had worn these were long dead. What to do with the goddamn stroller was the question, and a good one. Now that the reality of it being there was setting in, my first shock, closely followed by fear, was being replaced by curiosity and anger. What a shit way to start the morning. I had my cell phone in the pocket of my shorts. I called the county sheriff's department and asked for Officer P. Zane. The receptionist put me on hold, then came back and said Officer Zane was off duty until the following Monday. I knew better than to ask for a cop's personal number, so instead asked the dispatcher to please tell him Victor Trenton had called and would he please call back. I'll see what I can do, the woman said, a non-response that did nothing to ameliorate my shitty morning. You do that, I said, and ended the call. Mr. Ito would also not be in until the following Monday, and I wasn't expecting any other company, but I had no intention of letting that stroller sit in the courtyard. I decided to push it back to Mrs. Bell's and return it to the garage. It was on my usual walk, after all, and I might be able to tell if some practical joker, mean person had forced the garage door. First, though, I took a couple of photos of the perambulator in situ to show Zane. Assuming he was interested, that was. He might be less than happy that I'd moved the stroller from the courtyard where I found it, but was it evidence of a crime? Had Allie Bell been beaten to death with a perambulator perforce? No, I was just returning it to where we'd put it. I pushed it up the road under the simmering morning sun. Maybe the residual effects of the Ambien were still in my system, because once the fear had been dispelled by the pram's prosaic ordinariness, even the shorts and shirts were prosaic, the sort of clothing available in any Walmart or Amazon, I fell into a kind of daze. I suppose if I'd been in bed or even lying on the sofa, I would have drifted off into sleep. But because I was walking on Rattlesnake Road, I just let my mind float on its own current. Squeaky wheel, or no squeaky wheel, I really should oil it, I thought. The stroller was easy to push, especially without any four-year-old boys to weigh it down. I did it with my left hand. With my right, I touched the shirts hanging over the backs of the seats, first one, then the other. I didn't realize what I was doing until later. I thought of the boys crossing the road and then fighting their way toward the beach through the undergrowth. Not angry about it, not using their little boy cuss words if they got whapped in the face by a backswinging frond or when a jutting branch scraped an arm. Not angry, not impatient, not wishing they'd taken the boardwalk. They were deep in a shared fantasy. Jungle explorers, wearing newspaper hats their father had made them out of the Tribune's Sunday color funnies. Somewhere ahead, there might be a treasure chest left behind by pirates, or a gigantic ape like King Kong, a movie they had seen on Tampa Matinee at 4 o'clock, sitting cross-legged before the TV until their mom commandeered it for the nightly news with Tom Brokaw. They hear the rattling, low at first, but getting louder and closer as they push heroically onward. At first they ignore it, then make the fatal mistake of dismissing it. Joe thinks it might be bees and they could find honey. Jake asks him how many times his brother would like to get stung and tells him not to be stupid. They are after treasure. Honey is not treasure. The rattling sound is coming from the left and the right. No problem. The way to the beach is straight ahead. They can already hear the waves, and they will paddle their feet before digging in the sand for gold and building a castle if the treasure hunt yields no results. They want to wade in the water because it's hot. A hot day, like the one my little boy had to deal with. He had no water in which to paddle his feet. He was trapped in a hot car with his mommy because there was a monster outside. The monster wouldn't leave, and the car wouldn't go. They don't see the dip because it's masked by a tangle of bushes. Those bushes also hide a den of snakes, a rumba of rattlers that lives in its shade. Jake and Joe, side by side, could go around this overgrown clump of greenery, but that's not how brave explorers roll. Brave explorers go straight ahead, hacking away the greenery with invisible machetes. That's what they do, and because they're walking side by side, they plunge into the dip together and into the snakes. There are dozens of them. Some are still young, snakelets, and although they can bite, they cannot, contrary to popular belief, inject poison. But their bites are still painful, and most of the rattlers are adults in full protection mode. They shoot their diamond-shaped heads forward and sink their fangs deep. The boys cry out, "Ow!" and "Don't!" and "What?" and "That hurts!" They are bitten multiple times on the ankles and calves. Joe goes to one knee. A snake strikes his thigh and wraps its body around his knee like a tourniquet. Jake struggles out of the brush-filled dip wearing snakes like ankle bracelets. That rattling sound fills the world. He tries to pull Joe to his feet, and a snake sinks its fangs into the meat of his small palm as quick as winking. Joe is on his belly now, with snakes crawling all over him. He tries to protect his face, at least, and can't. He's bitten on his neck and cheeks, and when he turns his head in a futile effort to get away, on his nose and mouth, his face begins to swell. Jake turns and begins to blunder back to the road and the bell house on the other side, still wearing snakes around his ankles. One falls off. The other begins to twine its way up toward the leg of the boy's shorts, a rattlesnake barber pole. Why does he run when the two of them have always done everything together? Is it because he knows his twin brother is already beyond help? No. Because he's in a blind panic? No. Not even blind panic could cause him to abandon Joe. It's because he wants to get Daddy if he's still home. Mommy, if Daddy isn't. It's not panic. It's a rescue mission. Jake pulls the snake off his leg and has a moment to see its beady, assessing eyes before it buries its fangs in his wrist. He flings it away and tries to run, but he can't run. The poison is coursing through him now, making his heart beat erratically, making it hard to breathe. Joe is no longer screaming. Jake's vision doubles, then triples. He can no longer even walk, so he tries to crawl. His hands are swelling up like cartoon gloves. He tries to say his brother's name and can't because his throat. What brought me out of this vision was the clack and whine of the swing gate going up. The stroller I was pushing had broken the photoelectric beam that operates it. In my zombie state, I'd walked far past Allie's driveway. I saw my right hand was still going back and forth, touching first one shirt, Tweedledee, and then the other, Tweedledum. I pulled it back as if it were touching something hot. The day was still relatively cool, but my face was wet with sweat and my t-shirt was dark with it. I had only been walking, at least I thought so, couldn't remember for sure. But I was breathing fast, as if at the end of a 200-yard dash. I pulled the stroller back, and the swing gate went down. I asked myself what had just happened, but thought I knew. The other members of my team at the agency would have laughed, except maybe for Kathy Wilkin, who had an imagination that stretched further than taglines for toilet bowl cleaner, but I had no other way to explain it. I had seen movies and at least one TV documentary where so-called clairvoyants were called in by the police to help locate the bodies of people who were presumed dead, as bloodhounds are given an article of clothing to get the scent they're supposed to follow. The psychics were given articles that were deemed important to the person they were supposed to locate. Mostly the results had been bullshit, but in a few cases it had worked, or seemed to. It was the shirts. Touching the shirts. And the part about Tad? Those were my own memories, intruding on whatever vibe I'd been getting from those shirts. My son finding his way into my strange state of seeing wasn't surprising. He had died at about the same age as the Bell twins, and at close to the same time. Triplets instead of twins. Tragedy calling to tragedy. As I turned the stroller and started back, the vividness of my vision started to fade. I began to question the idea that I'd had an authentic psychic experience. It wasn't as though I didn't know what happened to the Bell twins after all. Maybe my mind had just added some details, like the concealed dip they'd fallen into. It might not have happened that way at all. Plus, there was no denying that I'd been in an extremely suggestible state because of the pram showing up as it had. That I couldn't explain. I ducked under the yellow tape and pushed the stroller up the curving driveway to the Bell house. Squeak, squeak, squeak. The garage's side door was standing open, swinging lazily back and forth in a light breeze. There were no splinters above or beneath the lock plate, and none on the door itself. It could have been loaded with a credit card, but it hadn't been forced. I studied the doorknobs, both outside and inside. There was a keyhole in the middle of the outside knob, which Officer Zane had used to lock the door. He didn't need a key to lock the inside. There was a button in the middle of that knob, and all you had to do was push it. The solution is simple, I thought. It was the twins. It was Jacob and Joseph. They just turned the inside knob. The button would pop out and the door would open, easy as winking. Then they pushed the stroller down to my place, Jake on one side and Joe on the other. Sure. And if you believed that, you'd believe we won in Vietnam. The moon landing was faked. The horror-stricken parents at Sandy Hook were crisis actors, and 9/11 was an inside job. And yet the garage door was open. And the stroller had turned up at my house a quarter of a mile away. My phone rang. I jumped. It was Officer P. Zane. The receptionist at the sheriff's department had come through after all.
Hello, Mr. Trenton. What can I do you for?
He sounded more relaxed today and much more southern, probably because it was his day off and he was in civilian mode.
I'm at the Bell house, I said, and told him why. I hardly need to add that I left out the part about my vision of the boys falling into the camouflaged snake pit.
There was a moment of silence when I finished. Then he said,
"Go ahead and put that stroller back in the garage, why don't you?"
He sounded unsurprised and not very concerned. Of course, he hadn't had a vision of snakes crawling all over Joe Bell as he shrieked,
"Somebody played a practical joke on you. Teenagers most likely sneaking up Rattlesnake Road to see where the crazy lady died. She kind of had that reputation in Palm Village."
You really think that's what it was?
What else could it be?
Ghosts, I thought. Ghost children. But I wasn't going to say it. I didn't even like thinking.
Maybe you're right.
They must have popped the lock with a credit card or driver's license, though. There's no sign of damage.
Sure, nothing to pop in a lock like that.
Easy as winking. He chuckled.
Got that right. Just put the stroller back and close the door. Deceased lady's keys are at the substation. Andy Pelley will pick them up. You remember who I'm talking about?
Sure, Super Gramp. He laughed.
Right, but don't call him that to his face. Anyway, he got his judge friend to sign that exigent circumstances widget so he can go in and do a search for next of kin and local contacts. Andy's a sharp old bird. If anyone's been in there, he'll know. We at least have to find someone who'll take responsibility for the lady's remains.
Remains, I thought, watching the door swing back and forth in the breeze. What a word.
I guess she can't just stay in the morgue, can she? We don't even have one. She's at the Perdomo Funeral Home on the Tamiami. Listen, since you're there and the garage is open, would you mind going inside and see if the lady's car got vandalized in any way? Punctured tires, broken windows, cracked windshield? Because we'd have to take that a little more serious.
Happy to. Sorry to interrupt you on your day off.
Don't you worry. I've had my breakfast, and now I'm just sitting out back and reading the paper. Call me if anything's wrong with the car. If there is, I'll inform Andy. And Mr. Trenton?
Why don't you make it Vic?
Okay, Vic. If you feel like the kids who took that stroller down to Mr. Ackerman's house might do it again, the sort of kids who pull shit like that ain't what you'd call creative. You can roll it back and put it in your garage.
I think I'll leave it here.
Fair enough. You have a good day now.
As I rolled the pram into the garage, rocking up the front end to get it over the jam, I realized I hadn't told Zane about the shorts and shirts either. The garage wasn't air-conditioned, and I began to sweat almost as soon as I was through the door. Other than needing a trip through the nearest car wash, the sides and windshield were crusted with salt, Allie's Chevy Cruze looked okay. I found myself staring at the empty car seats in the back. Of course, they were empty, and made myself look away. There were a number of cardboard cartons stacked along the back wall. Neatly lettered in magic marker on each was The J's. My mother had a saying, only snooping is lower than gossip. But my father liked to tease her with another one. Curiosity killed the cat, but satisfaction brought him back. I opened one of the boxes and saw board jigsaw puzzles, the kind with sturdy pieces in the shapes of animals. I opened another and found picture books, Dr. Seuss, Richard Scarry, the Berenstain Bears. Several more contained clothes, including shorts and paired t-shirts with various cute twinisms on them. So this was where the shorts and shirts on the stroller had come from. The question I had was whether or not a prankster would have known how Allie placed those things on the stroller like a child dressing invisible dolls. Officer Zane would have said, yeah, word gets around. I wasn't so sure. Grief sleeps but doesn't die. At least not until the griever does. This was a lesson I relearned when I opened the last carton. It was filled with toys, matchbox cars, playsticks, Star Wars figures, a folded Candyland game, and a dozen plastic dinosaurs. Our son had matchbox cars and toy dinosaurs. Loved them. My eyes stung, and my hands weren't quite steady as I closed up the carton. I wanted to get out of this hot, still garage, and maybe off Rattlesnake Key, too. I had come to finish grieving for my wife and all the years we'd foolishly wasted apart, not to reopen the long-healed wound of my boy's terrible death. Certainly not to have psychic flashes of the inside view type. I thought I'd give it another 2 or 3 days to be sure. And if I felt the same, I'd call Greg, thank him, and tell Mr. Ito to keep an eye on the place. Then I'd head back to Massachusetts, where it was hot in August, but not insanely hot. On the way out, I saw some tools, a hammer, a screwdriver, a couple of wrenches, on a shelf to the left of the door. There was also an old-fashioned oil can, the kind with a metal base you pump with your fingers, and a long nozzle that reminded me a little of Ally Bell's snake pole. I decided that even though I had no intention of pushing the pram back to Greg's house, I could at least oil that squeaky wheel. If there was any oil left in the can, that was. I picked it up and saw there was something else on the shelf. It was a file folder with Jake and Joe written on it, and in bigger letters, Save This. I flipped it open and saw two paper hats made out of the Sunday color funnies. I forgot all about oiling the squeaky wheel, and I didn't want to touch those homemade hats. Touching them might bring on another vision. In that hot garage, the idea didn't seem silly, but all too plausible. I shut the garage door and went home. When I got there, I turned on my phone and searched for Tampa Matinee. I didn't want to do it, but I'd found the hats, so I did. Siri brought me to a nostalgia site created by a former employer of WTVT, Tampa's CBS affiliate since back in the day. There was a list of local programs from the 50s to the 90s, a puppet show in the morning, a teen dance party on Saturday afternoons, and Tampa Matinee, an afternoon movie that ran from 4 to 6 each weekday afternoon until 1988. Once upon a time, only 3 years after my son died, Joe and Jake had sat cross-legged in front of the TV, watching King Kong clinging to the top of the Empire State Building. I had no doubt of it. We had 10 years after remarrying. 9 of them, before the cancer came back, were good. The last year, well, we tried to make it good, and for the first 6 months we mostly succeeded. Then the pain started to ramp up, going from serious to very serious to the kind where you can think of nothing else. Donna was brave about it. That lady had no shortage of guts. Once, she faced a rabid St. Bernard with nothing but a baseball bat. With the cancer burning through her, she had no weapon except for her own will. But for a long time, that was enough. Near the end, she was little more than a shadow of the woman I'd taken to bed that night in Providence. But to me, her beauty remained. She wanted to die at home, and I honored her wish. We had a day nurse and a part-time night nurse, but I mostly took care of her myself. I fed her, and when she could no longer make it to the bathroom, I changed her. I wanted to do those things because of all the missed years. There was a tree behind our house that split apart, maybe because of a lightning strike, and then grew back together, leaving a heart-shaped hole. That was us. If the metaphor seems overly sentimental, deal with it. I'm telling the truth as I understand it, as I felt it. Some people have worse luck. We did our best with what we were given. I lay in bed, staring up at the slowly turning blades of the overhead fan. I was thinking of the stroller with the squeaky wheel and the newspaper hats and the toy dinosaurs. But mostly, I thought of the night Donna died, which was a memory I had avoided. Now it seemed somehow necessary. There was a nor'easter, with heavy snow blowing and drifting in a 40-mile-an-hour wind. The night nurse called from Lewiston at 3 that afternoon and canceled. The roads, she said, were impassable. The lights flickered several times, but hadn't gone out, which was good. I wasn't sure what I'd do if they did. Donna had been switched from OxyContin tablets to a morphine pump in late December. It stood sentinel by her bed, and it ran on electricity. Donna was sleeping. It was cold in our bedroom. The furnace couldn't keep up with that howling January wind. But her thin cheeks were wet with sweat, and what remained of her once thick hair clung to the fragile curve of her skull. I knew she was close to the end, and so did her oncologist. He had taken the limiter off the morphine pump, and now its little light always glowed green. He gave me the obligatory warning that too much would kill her, but didn't seem overly concerned. Why would he? The cancer had eaten most of her already, and was now gobbling the leftovers. I sat beside her as I had for most of the time during the last 3 weeks. I watched her eyes moving back and forth under her bruised-looking lids as she dreamed her dying dreams. There was a bag inside the pump, I reasoned, and maybe if the power went out, I could get a screwdriver from the basement and... Her eyes opened. I asked how she was doing, how bad the pain was. Not bad, she said. Then, he wanted to see the ducks. Who did, honey? Dad. He said he wanted to see the ducks. I think it was the last thing he said to me. What ducks, do you think? I don't know. Do you remember any ducks? Maybe this time we took him to the Rumford Petting Zoo. I didn't remember ever taking him there. Yeah, that's probably it. I think she looked past me. Her face brightened. Oh, my God. You're all grown up. Look how tall you are. I turned my head. No one there, of course, but I knew who she was seeing. The wind gusted, shrieking around the eaves and throwing snow against the shuttered bedroom window so hard that it sounded like gravel. The lights dimmed, then came back, but somewhere a door crashed open.
"You wouldn't breathe!"
Donna screamed. I went goose flesh from head to toe. I think my hair stood up. I'm not sure, but I really think it did. I wouldn't have believed she still had the strength to scream, but she always surprised me. Right to the end, she surprised me. The wind was in the house now, a burglar eager to turn the place upside down. I could feel it rushing under the closed bedroom door. Something in the living room fell and broke.
"Breathe, Tad, breathe!"
Something else fell over. A chair, maybe. Donna had somehow managed to get up on her elbows, supported by upper arms not much thicker than pencils. Now she smiled and lay back down.
"All right," she said. "I will." "Yes."
It was like listening to one end of a phone conversation.
"Yes. Okay. Good. Thank God you are."
"What?"
She nodded.
"I will."
She closed her eyes, still smiling. I left the room to shut the front door where there was already a fantail of snow almost an inch deep. When I came back, my wife was dead. You may scoff at the idea that our son came to escort her out of this life, and you are welcome to. I, on the other hand, once heard my little boy's voice coming from his closet while he was dying a dozen miles away. I never told anyone about that, not even Donna. These memories circled and circled. They were buzzards. They were rattlesnakes. They pecked, stung, wouldn't let me go. Around midnight, I took two more of Greg's expired Ambien, lay back down, and waited for them to work. Still thinking of how Donna saw Tad grown to manhood as she passed out of the world. That her life ended in such a way should have had a calming effect on me, but it didn't. The memory of her deathbed kept connecting to the vision I'd had of the boys falling into the snake pit and coming back to reality to discover my hand going back and forth between Tweedledum and Tweedledee, feeling their leavings, their remains. I thought, what if I saw them the way Donna saw Tad at the end? What if I actually saw them? Allie did. I know she did. Seeing Tad had comforted Donna as she crossed the border from life to death. Would those boys comfort me? I didn't think so. Their comforter was gone. I was a stranger. I was... what? What was I to them? I didn't want to know. Didn't want to be haunted by them and the idea that it might be happening. That was what was keeping me awake. I was just beginning to drift off when I heard the rhythmic squeaking. It started all at once, and there was no way I could pretend it was the overhead fan in Greg's living room. It was coming from the ensuite bathroom of this very bedroom. Squeak and squeak and squeak. I was terrified, as a person can only be when they're alone in a house at the end of a mostly deserted road. But if Donna could face down a rabid St. Bernard with nothing but a baseball bat in defense of her son, surely I could look into the bathroom? It even crossed my mind as I turned on the night table lamp and got out of bed that I was imagining that sound. Hadn't I read somewhere that Ambien can cause hallucinations? I walked to the left of the bathroom door and stood there against the wall, biting my lip. I turned the knob and pushed the door open. Now the squeaking was louder than ever. It was a big bathroom. Someone was pushing that stroller around in there. Back and forth, back and forth. I reached around the jamb, terribly afraid. I think we always are in such situations, that a hand would close over mine. I found the light switch, fumbled with it for an agonizing length of time that was probably only 2 or 3 seconds, and flicked it up. The overheads were fluorescents, nice and bright. In most cases, light is a reliable dispeller of night terrors. Not this time. I still couldn't see into the bathroom from where I was standing, but on the wall opposite, I could see a large shadow going back and forth. It was too amorphous for me to be sure it was that goddamn stroller, but I knew it was. And were the boys pushing it? How else could it have gotten here? Boys, I tried to say, but all that came out was a dry whisper. I cleared my throat and tried again. Boys, you're not wanted here. You're not welcome here. I realized I was speaking a bastardized version of the monster words with which I had once comforted my little boy. It's my bathroom, not yours. It's my house, not yours. Go back to where you came from. And where would that be? In 2 child-sized coffins under the earth of Palmetto Grove Cemetery? Were their rotting bodies, their rotting remains, pushing that stroller maniacally back and forth? Were pieces of their dead flesh falling off onto the floor? Squeak and squeak and squeak. The shadow on the wall. Gathering every last ounce of my courage, I stepped away from the wall and went through the door. The squeaking stopped. The abandoned stroller was standing in front of the glass shower stall. Now there were 2 pairs of black pants draped over the seats and 2 black coats draped over the backs. Those were burial suits, meant to be worn forever. While I stared at the pram, frozen by the horror of this thing that had no earthly way to be there, a rattling replaced the pram's squeaky wheel. It was low at first, as if coming from a distance, but rising until it was the sound of dry bones being shaken in 12 gourds. I had been looking at the shower stall. Now I looked at Greg's fancy clawfoot tub, which was long and deep. It was filled to the brim with rattlesnakes. As I watched, one small supplicating hand rose from the twisting mass, that bathtub rumba, and stretched out to me. I fled. It was the stroller that brought me back to myself. It was standing in the middle of the flagstone courtyard just as it had before. Only now its shadow was being thrown by a 3/4 moon instead of morning light. I have no memory of running downstairs, wearing only the gym shorts I slept in, or out the patio door. I know I must have come that way because I found it standing open when I went back in. I left the stroller where it was. I went back upstairs, dreading every step, telling myself it had been a dream, except for the stroller outside. Its presence was undeniable. Knowing it hadn't been. Not a vision, either. It had been a visitation. The only thing that kept me from spending the rest of the night in my rental car with the doors locked was my clear sense that the visitation was over. The house was empty again, except for me. Soon, I told myself, it would be entirely empty. I had no intention of staying on Rattlesnake Key when I had a perfectly good house to go back to in Newburyport. The only ghost there was the memory of my dead wife. The bathroom was empty, as I'd known it would be. There were no rattlesnakes in the tub and no wheel tracks on the faux marble floor. I went to the gallery and looked down on the courtyard, hoping the stroller would be gone too. No such luck. It stood there in the moonlight, as real as roses. But at least it was outside. I went back to bed, and believe it or not, I slept. The stroller was still there in the morning, this time with identical white shorts on the seats. Only when I got closer, I saw they weren't completely identical after all.
There were red pinstripes running down the legs of one and blue down the other. The shirts bore identical crows, one named Heckle and one named Jekyll. I had no intention of rolling it back down to Allie Bell's house. After a long career in the advertising business, I knew an exercise in futility when I encountered one. I put it in my garage instead. You might ask if it all seemed like a dream in the bright light of morning, with the exception of the restless stroller, that is. The answer is simple. It did not. I had heard the squeaking and seen the moving shadow as the twins pelted their pram furiously back and forth in that bathroom, which was almost the size of a modest apartment's living room. I had seen the tub filled with snakes. I waited until 9 o'clock to call Delta Airlines. A recorded voice advised me that all reservation agents were currently busy and invited me to hold. I did, at least until a version of Stairway to Heaven by the 100 Comatose Strings came on, then gave up and went to American. Same thing. JetBlue, ditto. Southwest had a flight to Cleveland on Thursday, no connecting flight scheduled to Boston, but that might change, the agent told me. It was hard to tell. Thanks to the coronavirus, everything was crazy. I booked the flight to Cleveland, thinking if no connecting flight materialized, I could rent a car, drive to Boston, and Uber to Newburyport. By then it was 9:30. I was very aware of the stroller sitting out in my garage. It was like having a hot stone in my pocket. I went to the Hertz site on my phone and was put on terminal hold. Same with Avis and Enterprise. An agent answered the phone at Budget, checked his computer, and told me they had no one-way rental cars available in Cleveland. That left Amtrak and the bus lines. But by then I was frustrated and tired of holding the phone to my ear. I kept thinking of the stroller, the shirts, the child-sized black burial suits. The light of a hot August day should have helped. It didn't. The more my options closed off, the more I wanted, needed, to get out of Greg's house and away from Allie Bell's down the road. What had felt like a place to recover near the serenity of the Gulf now felt like a prison. I got a cup of coffee, paced around the kitchen, and tried to think of what I should do. It was hard to think of anything but the stroller, squeak, and the matching shirts, squeak, and the black burial suits, squeak. The coffins had also been matching, white, with gold handles. I knew this. I drank the coffee black and another penny dropped. The nighttime visitation might be over, but the haunting was still going on. Thursday. I concentrated on that. I had a flight at least as far as Cleveland on Thursday, 3 days from now. Get off the key until then. Do that much at least, can you? At first I thought I could. Easy as winking. I grabbed my phone, found Barry's Resort Hotel in Palm Village and called. Surely they would have a room where I could stay for 3 nights. Hadn't I seen on the news that few people were traveling this summer? Why, the place would probably welcome me, squeak, with open arms. What I got was a recorded message shortened to the point.
Thank you for calling Barry's Resort Hotel. We are closed until further notice.
I called Holiday Inn Express in Venice and was told they were open but taking no new guests. Motel 6 in Sarasota didn't answer at all. As a last resort, little pun there, squeak, I called the Days Inn in Bradenton. Yes, I was told they had rooms. Yes, I could reserve one, providing I passed a temperature check and wore a mask. I took the room, although Bradenton was 40 miles away and 2 counties over. Then I went outside to try and clear my head before packing. I could have gone through the garage, but chose the patio door instead. I didn't want to look at the stroller, let alone oil the squeaky wheel. The twins might not like it. I was standing by the pool when an F-150 pickup truck, blinding in the summer sun, came down the driveway and pulled up in the courtyard, exactly where I'd found the goddamn stroller both times. The man who got out was wearing a tropical shirt with parrots on it, very large khaki shorts, and a straw sun hat of the type only lifelong residents of Florida's Gulf Coast can seem to get away with. He had a seamed, suntanned face and a really huge walrus mustache. He saw me and waved. I went down the steps from the patio to the courtyard, already holding out my hand. I was glad to see him. It broke the repeating loop in my head. I think seeing anyone would have done it, but I was pretty sure I knew who this was. Super Gramp. Instead of taking my hand, he offered his elbow. I gave it a bump, thinking this was now the new normal.
Andy Pelly, and you're Mr. Trenton.
Right.
Don't have the COVID, Mr. Trenton?
No, do you?
Clean as a whistle, as far as I know.
I was grinning like a fool, and why? Because I was happy to see him. So happy to not be thinking about black suits and white coffins and squeaky wheels. You know who you look like?
Oh boy, do I ever. Get it all the time.
Then with a smile below the mustache and a twinkle in his eye, he did a passable Wilfred Brimley imitation.
Quaker Oats. It's the right thing to do.
I laughed giddily. Perfect! Nailed it! Babbling. Couldn't help it. That was a seriously good campaign, and I should know because you used to be in advertising. He was still smiling, but I had been wrong about the twinkle in those blue eyes. It was actually a look of assessment, a cop look.
You handled the Sharp Cereals account, didn't you?
A long time ago, I said, thinking, he's looked me up online. Investigated me. Why, I don't know. Unless he thinks I...
Got a few questions for you, Mr. Trenton. Maybe we could go inside. Awful hot out here. Guess the cold front's gone the way of the blue suede shoe.
Of course. And really, make it Vic.
Vic? Vic, got it.
I meant to take him up the steps to the patio, but he was already headed for the garage. He stopped when he saw the stroller.
Huh. Preston Zane told me you returned that to Mrs. Bell's garage.
I did. Someone brought it back. Again. I wanted to resume babbling, telling him I didn't know why, had no idea why the stroller was following me around, following me like a bad smell, if a bad smell could squeak, that was. But the assessing look was back in his sun-crinkled eyes, and I made myself stop.
Huh. Two nights in a row. Wow.
His eyes saying how unlikely that was, asking me if I was lying, asking if I had a reason to lie, something to hide. I wasn't lying, but I certainly did have something to hide, because I didn't want to be dismissed as a crazy person, or even considered as someone who'd had something to do with Allie Bell's death, the fabled person of interest. But that was ridiculous, wasn't it?
Why don't we go inside and grab some air conditioning, Vic?
Fine, I made coffee if you...
Nope, goes right through me these days. But I wouldn't mind a glass of cold water, maybe even with an ice cube in it. You're really not sick, are you? Because you look a little pale.
I'm not. Not the way he thought. Pelly took no chances. He took a mask out of his voluminous shorts and put it on as soon as we were inside. I got him ice water and poured myself more coffee. I thought about donning my own mask and decided not to. I wanted him to see my whole face. We sat at the kitchen table. Each time he sipped his water, he pulled the mask down, then returned it to its place. The mustache made it bulge.
I understand you found Mrs. Bell. Must have been a shock.
It was. The sense of relief at having company, another human being in the haunted mansion, was being replaced by caution. This guy might be in what Canavan had called the 1042 Club, but Zane was right. He was sharp. I thought I was in for an interrogation rather than a courtesy stop-by. Happy to tell you what happened, how I found her, but since I've got you here, I'm curious about something.
How are you now?
Those eyes on mine. There were smile lines radiating out from their corners, but they weren't currently at work. Officer Zane told me you've been around here for a long time.
Donkey's years, he said,
sipping his water, wiping at his mustache with one big farmer's hand, then returning the mask to its place. I know about the rattlesnakes that killed Mrs. Bell's twins. What I'm curious about is how the posse got rid of them. Do you know?
Oh, you bet.
For the first time, he seemed to relax.
Should, since I was in on that snake hunt. Every cop in the county who didn't have the duty was in on it, plus plenty more guys and even a few gals. Must have been 100 of us, maybe more. Regular island party, except no one was having fun. Was a hot day, a lot hotter than this one, but all of us were wearing boots, long pants, shirts with long sleeves, gloves, masks like the one I'm wearing now, and veils.
Veils?
Some were beekeepers' veils, some were made of that stuff. Tulle, maybe? Ladies wear on their Sunday hats. At least they did in the old days. Because you see,
leaning forward, staring me in the eye, and looking more like Wilfred Brimley than ever.
You see, a snake will sometimes rear up, if it's scared enough, that is. Spray that poison instead of injecting it. If it gets in your eyes, he waved his hand. Short trip to your brain. Good night and good luck.
And then, with no pause,
I see your midnight visitor brought back Mrs. Bell's snake pole, too.
He meant to catch me off guard, and he succeeded.
What? Saw it in the garage, leaning against the back wall.
His gaze never leaving mine, waiting for my eyes to shift away or any other tell. I held my eyes steady, but I blinked. Couldn't help it.
You must have missed that.
I did, I guess. I didn't know how to finish, so I just shrugged.
Recognized it right away by the little silver ring on the handle. Lady went just about everywhere with it, at least on the key. Many folks along Rattlesnake Road and over the swing bridge in the village knew it, too.
And the stroller, I said.
Yeah, she liked to push the stroller, talking to it sometimes, talking to those gone boys of hers. I've seen her doing it myself.
So did I. He waited. I thought of saying, that stroller was in my bathroom last night and the dead twins were pushing it.
You asked about the snakes.
He sipped his water and wiped his mustache with a cupped hand. Up went the mask.
The great snake drive of 82 or 83. I'd have to look it up to be sure. Or maybe you already did, Vic.
I shook my head.
Well, those of us who didn't have snake poles had baseball bats, rug beaters, or tennis rackets. All kinds of things. To whack the brush with, you know. Also fishing nets. No shortage of nets on the go. All the West Coast keys are narrow, and this one's narrower than most. Gulf on one side, Calypso Bay on the other. Only 600 yards across at its widest point, and that's down by the swing bridge. This end, where the rattlers migrated to when all the buildings started down south, is about half that. From here, you can see both the Gulf and the bay, right?
From the side yard, yes.
This house wasn't even there then. Just palmettos and beech and alpaca. The snakes loved that. And trash pines. Plus lots of bushes I don't even know the names of. We spread out in a line from the Gulf to Calypso, and north we went, beating the bushes and dragging those nets and pounding on the ground. Snakes don't have much hearing, but they can feel vibrations. They knew we were coming. You could see the foliage shaking, especially the alpaca. Must have felt like an earthquake to them. And when we got toward the end of the key, where the greenery ends, we could see them. Those suckers were everywhere. It was like the ground was moving. We couldn't believe it. And the rattling, I can hear it still.
Like dry bones in a gourd. He gave me a fixed look.
Right. How do you know that?
Seen them in the Franklin Park Zoo? I told this lie with a straight face. That's in Boston. Also, you know, in nature programs.
Well, it's a good description. Only you have to think of dozens of gourds, maybe hundreds, and a whole graveyard full of bones.
I thought of Greg's big bathtub, and one hand rising out of the writhing mass.
Have you been to the north end of the Key, Vic?
I walked up there just the other day. He nodded.
I haven't been there on foot since the snake hunt, but I've seen it plenty of times out fishing. The Key has changed a lot in the last 40 years or so. Been built up something terrible. But the north end is just the same now as it was then. A shell beach that looks like a great big lopsided triangle, am I right? Just right, I said. He nodded. The mask went down. A sip of water. The mask went up. That's where snakes ended up. With no place to go except Daylight Pass. Backs to the water, you could say. Except snakes are all back, aren't they? That half acre of beach was covered with them. You couldn't see the shells at all, except every now and then for a split second or two as they moved around, shaking their tails. They were crawling all over each other, too. Enough poison in those snakes to kill half the people in Tampa, you would have said. We had a bunch of firemen from the Palm Village Station and a bunch more from up Highway 41 in Nokomis. Big strapping fellas. Had to be. Because they had 20-gallon smoke chaser packs on their backs. What used to be called Indian pumps. Those things were made more for fighting brush fires, of which we have a lot, but they didn't hold water that day. They were filled with kerosene. When we had the snakes, most of them, folks found strays for months after, with nothing but water behind them, those boys sprayed them very good and proper. Then my old friend Jerry Gant, Palm Village fire chief, long gone, fired up a Burns-O-Matic propane torch and flung it. Those rattlers went up in a sheet of flame and the stink. Oh, my God, it was terrible. I could never get it out of my clothes. None of us could. Washing them didn't do any good. They had to be burned, like the snakes. He sat quiet for a moment, eyes on his glass of water. He would return to the reason he'd come, but right now he wasn't here at all. He was seeing those burning rattlesnakes and smelling their stench as they writhed in the flames. Duma was still there back then, and some of the snakes swam for it. Maybe a few even made it, but most drowned. I don't know if you noticed there's a whirlpool where the water from the bay meets the water from the gulf. I've seen it. That whirlpool, that eddy, was stronger when Duma Key was still there, because the water came through with a lot more force. I bet it's 16 feet deep right there where the water spins, maybe more. Dug out the channel bed, you know. Plus the tide was low that day, which increases the spill from the bay. We saw snakes spinning in that eddy, some still on fire. And that, Vic, was the great snake drive of 80-whatever. Quite a story. Now you tell me one, about how you knew Alida Bell and how you found her. I didn't know her at all, and I only saw her twice. Alive, I mean. The second time, she brought me oatmeal raisin cookies. We ate some at this very table, had them with milk. I said hello to the twins. Did you know? Maybe it sounds crazy, but it didn't feel crazy. It felt like the polite thing to do. Because in all other ways, she struck me as completely rational. In fact, I frowned, trying to remember. She said she knew they weren't there. Huh. Hadn't she also said, and yet they are? I thought so, but I couldn't quite remember. If she had, she was right. I knew that now for myself. And someone brought that stroller back. Not once, but twice. Yes. But you didn't see anyone? No. Didn't hear anyone? No. Didn't notice the motion lights going on either? Because I know Ackerman had them put in. No. Didn't bring the snake pole back either? No. Tell me about how you found her. I did, including the part about throwing a shell, maybe more than one. I had been upset and was no longer sure, to get the buzzards away from her body. I told all that to Officers Zane and Canavan. I know you did. It's in their report. Except, of course, for the stroller turning up the second time. That's what you call new information. I can't help you with that. I was asleep. Huh. Down went the mask. He finished his water. Up went the mask. Pete Ito says you're planning on staying until September, Mr. Trenton. It wasn't lost on me that he'd spoken to Mr. Ito, nor was it lost on me that he had reverted to my last name. Plans change. Finding a dead woman being pecked at by buzzards can do that to a person. I have a reservation at the Bradenton Days Inn tonight and a flight from Tampa to Cleveland on Thursday. Transportation the rest of the way to my home in Massachusetts is TBD. Things are pretty crazy in America just now.
Crazy. That word seemed to come out with more force than I intended.
Crazy all over the world, Pelly said. Why would you come down here in the summer anyway? Most people don't unless they've got free coupons from Disney World.
If he had talked to Pete Ito, I was sure he knew. Yes, this was an interrogation, all right. My wife died recently. I've been trying to come to grips with it.
And you, what, feel like you've got a grip pretty good just now?
I looked at him dead on. He didn't look like Wilfred Brimley to me anymore. He looked like a problem.
What is this about, Deputy Pelly?
Or should I call you Mr. Pelly? I understand you're retired.
Semi. Not a detective these days, but a part-time deputy in good standing. And you need to cancel your flight plans.
Was there a slight emphasis on the word flight?
I'm sure they'll take the charge off your credit card. Motel room, too. I guess you could go as far as Barry's over in the village, but...
Barry's is closed. I tried it.
What's... But tell you what. I'd be more comfortable if you stayed right here until Mrs. Bell has been autopsied. Which is to say, Mr. Trenton, the county sheriff's department would be more comfortable.
I'm not sure you could stop me.
I wouldn't test that if I were you. Just a friendly piece of advice.
I heard it then. Faint but audible.
Squeak and squeak and squeak.
I told myself I didn't. Told myself it was ridiculous. Told myself I wasn't in a story called The Telltale Pram.
Again, Mr. Pelly, Deputy Pelly,
what's this about? You're acting like the woman was murdered and I'm a suspect. Pelly was unperturbed.
Autopsy will most likely tell us how she died. Most likely that'll let you off the hook.
I had no idea I was on one.
As for what this is about, complicating matters, you could say, there's this. Found it on the kitchen table when I went in her house this morning at 6 o'clock.
He fiddled with his phone, then passed it over. He had taken a picture of a white business envelope. On it, in neat cursive, was, to be opened in event of my death, and Alita Marie Bell.
The envelope wasn't sealed, so I went ahead and opened it. Swipe to the next photo.
I did. The note that had been in the envelope was written in the same neat cursive, and the date at the top.
This is the day after we had the milk and cookies.
The squeaks were coming from below, in the garage. And as with the police in the Poe story, Pelly didn't seem to hear them. But he was an old guy, and maybe on the deaf side.
Was it now?
Yes, and some nice conversation. I wasn't going to tell him that Allie had sent Jake and Joe into Greg's study to play and I'd later found the wicker basket of cat toys overturned. That was the last thing I was going to tell this sharp-eyed but possibly dull-eared man. Nor would I tell him that I had conversed more or less with the twins myself. Hello, Jake. Hello, Joe. What do you know? It had been a harmless nod to an old lady's wistful fantasy. So I thought. But who knows when you open the door to a haunting, or how?
Go on and read the rest.
I did. It was brief and informal. This is my last will and testament, revoking all previous wills, which is silly, because in my case there are no others. I am sound of mind, if a little less so in body. I leave this house, my bank account at First Sun Trust, my investment account with Building the Future, LLC, and all other worldly possessions to Victor Trenton, currently living at 1567 Rattlesnake Road. My lawyer, who I didn't consult when I wrote this, is Nathan Rutherford in Palm Village. Signed, Alita Marie Bell. There was another signature below it, in a different hand. Roberto M. Garcia, witness. I forgot about the squeaking from the garage, or maybe it stopped. I read her death letter, nothing else to call it, over again. A third time. Then I slid Pelly's phone back across the table a little harder than I had to.
He blocked it like a hockey puck with one tanned and wrinkled hand.
That's crazy.
You'd think so, wouldn't you?
I only met her twice. Three times if you count finding her dead.
No idea why she'd leave you everything?
No. And hey, that note will never stand up in court. I'd say her relatives would go nuclear, but they won't have to because I won't contest it.
Roberto Garcia owns Plant World. They did her groundskeeping.
Yes, I've seen their trucks in her driveway.
Bobby G's also been around here for donkey's years. If he says he saw her write that, I have spoken to him, and he says, yeah, he did, although she held her hand over it when he signed so he didn't know what was in it, then I gotta believe it.
Doesn't change anything. My words came out okay, but my whole face fell.